Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. For those of you who are eating eggs every day, think again. As much as one egg can create an increase of 60% in your risk of diabetes. University of South Australia and the Chinese Medical University and Cotter University, three separate research centers, conducted the research and found that over a 10-year period, get rid of the eggs because it's not good for your health, has adverse effects. But this is new in that it would impact diabetes. And yes, it does impact diabetes. Quote, diet is a known and modifiable factor that contributes to the onset of type 2 diabetes. So understanding the range of dietary factors that might impact the growing prevalence of the disease is important. Over the past few decades, China has undergone a substantial nutritional transition that's seen many people move away from a traditional diet, comparing grains and vegetables to a more processed diet that includes greater amounts of meat, snacks, and energy-dense foods. Then it goes on to talk about what this actually means. At the same time, egg consumption has also been steadily increasing. The number of people eating eggs in China today has doubled. And then they talk about the association of egg eating and diabetes. And there it is. Quote, the egg eating had an increased risk of diabetes by 60%, end quote. That's a big deal. So get rid of the eggs and protect yourself against diabetes. Also today, you're going to watch a very short clip and hear a short clip, it's only about a minute, from a woman in Denmark talking about what they just won. Hundreds of thousands of people in Denmark went to the streets with pots and pans banging because the Danish government was about to impose a law to determine who would be forced by police order and detention to get a mandatory vaccine. And the Danish people had had enough. And they filled up their parliament and they said no. And they won. And it's important. And by the way, you can go to prn.fm, scroll down on the left-hand side. You can watch these videos as we're unfolding them today. So that's important, fighting back. Why can't we fight back in America? We should. We must. And we're working on a call to action now for a day of protesting in Albany and New York City. Close down everything to show that we, the people, are not going to be commodified any longer by the weaponization of the COVID virus. And in that light today, we're going to play you a short clip, two short clips, one's 2 minutes, one's 16, about one of the most respected scientists, medical doctors in the world, 50 years in practice, also a professor, heads the Department of Immunology, has a background in virology. And his wife has a background in oncology. He's a very humble person. And he says, and he's published hundreds of articles in the peer-reviewed literature, and he says that I could no longer stay silent. My wife and I had to speak to the truth. We've been lied to about COVID. All right. COVID's a real virus. Yes. COVID can kill people. Yes. But everything else you've been told is a lie. Listen to him and ask, why doesn't CNN, the New York Times, Washington Post, why don't they interview him? They could. We're going to have a short interview with him today and an hour interview later in the week. Also, I see a lot of brave people in our society. I see a lot of loving people, caring people. I see an abundance of positive people of all ethnicities, all cultures, all ages, all backgrounds, who have learned to live and work together, to harmonize. And yet you would never know that, listening and watching the mainstream media. It's all about hate and violence, terrible violence. I just watched a clip this morning of some of the people coming back from Trump's rally in Washington. Fine. you know, it's a free country, freedom of speech. I don't support Trump, never have. But when people go there to give support and then they're walking back to their hotel, a bunch of children with their parents, and they're physically attacked and assaulted by people who don't believe they should have that right, and other people beaten, pummeled, kicked. And this is what passes for dialogue. This is what passes for being able to have a different point of view. No. We as a country abhor violence, and yet we are imperfect because we have sponsored violence around the world. I brought that to you through my entire career. But if you ask the average American what their values are, what they look forward to every day, how they live their lives, the vast majority live very ethical, decent, and moral lives. I'm going to show you that today. Also, I'm going to play a simple statement by Rudyard Kipling called If. And then I'm going to play a simple clip of just a regular guy, just a regular American going shopping and what he sees and what happens from that. And I see this all the time. And I'll explain where I see it and why I believe that we should not overlook these gestures of kindness that permeate the entire fabric of the American psyche. It's not about left and right. It's not about ideologies, tech, and ultra rich people suggesting they know best for us. It's not about guiding our lives through the newest artificial intelligence or transhumanism. It's just being a human being at the high end of the ethical scale of that. That's our show. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. Now, the next study that's important comes from the German Federal Institute for Risk Assessment. And they simply took a look at the average vegan diet. And they found that vitamin B12 is well supplemented, but iodine is a matter of concern. So there was no significant difference with regard to vitamin B12, which was present in approximately the same amount in the blood of both groups, those who were vegan, those who were meat eaters. And since vitamin B12 is taken up almost exclusively by animal food, the supply of participants following a vegan diet could be due to the intake of dietary supplements, which is good. I suggest that you take a multiple vitamin each day that has vitamin B12 in it. That way you make sure you're getting it. But then they took a look and they found that iodine was not up to what it should have been in the blood and urine samples in this vegan group. So that, again, is very simple. Simply encourage a healthier diet by bringing iodine-rich foods, such as sea vegetables. You can have sea vegetables cold in a salad, and it's very exotic, nice tasting. And I always blend something like a hijiki salad or a kombu salad or a wakame salad. And I'll put something just the opposite, and I'll put pomegranate berries in, and with arugula, and then some endive, and then drizzle a nice sauce on top, a sauce like a tangerine lime sauce. Delicious salad. But you've got to get the iodine, miso soup, with some sea vegetables, iodine. Simple. Now, resveratrol, R-E-S-V-E-R-A-T-R-O-L, resveratrol, shows promise in reducing stroke symptoms that can affect neuronal function. This according to Mashhad University of Medical Sciences. So according to this study, stroke is one of the most important causes of death and disability in modern and developing societies. In a stroke, both the glial cells and the neurons develop apoptosis due to decreased cellular access to glucose and oxygen. In effect, they're starved to death. And that's why I always recommend get hyperbaric oxygen therapy the moment you have a stroke. It can save your brain. Well, what we have found is resveratrol, and when it breaks down 3-5-4 trihydroxytransilbene, which is an herbal compound, shows neuroprotective and glioprotective effects. And that's important. In this scientific study and its article showed how resveratrol can alleviate symptoms after stroke to help neurons to survive by modulating some signaling pathways in the glia. That's GLIA. And this has been shown in various PubMed and Medline and Scopus research. So it's there. This has been going on for 20 years. But we're just now finding more and more uses for this wonderful nutrient that should be in our diet every day. From the University of Zurich comes a study about vitamin D and the omega-3 fatty acids together. They bolster the health in active older people. In fact, in one study, 1 in 3 people in Europe will be over the age of 65. In the near future, that's a whole lot of older people, and all those people want to enjoy their old age and lead an active lifestyle. And to be able to do that, however, it is crucial that people maintain their physical and mental health. So there's a need for a simple and inexpensive prevention program that can help everyone, and vitamin D and the omega-3 fatty acids can help with that. So that's important, especially when you're over the age of 50 or 60. And there's the largest European study on old age, what is called DO, Health, has investigated the effects of these supplements on aging. And a professor of geriatric medicine and aging at the University of Zurich headed the clinic and did the research. And the findings were exercise every day and have vitamin D and omega-3 supplementation that can lower your infection rates and systolic blood pressure. And this was the largest study, double-blind study ever done on old age. So good for them for doing that. And also, 1/3 of people with cancer are now using complementary and alternative medicines. University of Texas says this. That's a stunning 1/3 of people with cancer diagnosis use some form of complementary and alternative medicine, meditation, yoga, acupuncture, herbal medicine, or even supplements. Now, are they using the heavy-duty ones that would really make a difference? No. Intravenous vitamin C, homeopathic preparations, and ozone, and juicing, no. But even the fact that they're getting some help with that is important. And I believe that we need more of this. And herbal supplements were the most common alternative medicine, and chiropractic or osteopathic manipulation was the second most common. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Oncology. And it was interesting because the group most likely to use alternative therapies were younger patients. They were more likely because they're more educated. They have greater access to researching materials. They're more interested in researching materials. And they're doing this without the doctor asking. They're doing it on their own. And that's a good thing. So the more you do on this, the better it is. In fact, because so many people are interested in the topic, next week I'll be doing a alternative discussion on the whole hour on alternative approaches to cancer to show you how much real science is there, lots, on natural and non-toxic ways of dealing with cancer. And also today, 1 year of using the omega-3 fatty acids was, according to Brigham and Women's Hospital, was able to impact cardiovascular risk by lowering it, less heart attack, less congestive heart failure, by using the omega-3s for 1 year. That's this study. One more reason to make sure that these are in your diet every day. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. And to help the people in this audience who are concerned, they don't know what to believe, who to believe. All they know is their life has been turned upside down. Some people have members of their family who are deeply depressed. Other people have found that members that needed medical treatment were afraid of going to hospital, so they stayed at home and didn't get their cancer treatment, diabetes treatment, heart disease treatment, and they died. And yet all those deaths were called COVID. COVID had nothing to do with those deaths. The COVID protocols had everything to do with locking people up, locking everyone together in a closed environment, dangerous and irresponsible. So what we're doing is we're finding some of the world's most outstanding scholars, scientists, physicians, who are risking their reputation coming forward and challenging Anthony Fauci, the White House Task Force, and Big Pharma. They're going up against enormous odds. These are simply people who can no longer stay silent. So they're risking all to tell you the truth. So we're going to come back. And when we come back, we're going directly into a professor. He is Professor Sukrat Bakadi. He will be in two short segments. I'll give a commentary in between the two segments. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
You're telling me that we've just shut down the country for the second time here in the UK. You're telling me that quite possibly the results of the election in America, you're telling me that the whole world has changed because of something that isn't true.
That's exactly what I'm trying to tell you.
Hello and welcome to Trigonometry. I'm Francis Foster.
I'm Constantine Kisson.
And this is a show for you if you want honest conversations with fascinating people.
And a very special guest we have for you today. He's the former chair of medical microbiology at the University of Mainz. Dr. Sachar Bhakti, welcome to Trigonometry.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. We really look forward to talking with you about your thoughts on the coronavirus, lockdowns, your book, obviously, which you've written with your wife about it. But before we get into that, tell us, for our viewers who may not be familiar with you, particularly in this country, because you're based in Germany, what is your history through life? Who are you? How are you where you are? What is your expertise and how are you qualified to talk about these issues?
Well, I don't want to talk so much about myself, but I am a born Thai. My parents were in the USA when I was born. That was just after the end of the World War. Mm-hmm. And my father was a diplomat. And as he was sort of moving around the world, as I have been, so I went to school in Switzerland, then in Egypt, went to the English school in Egypt, Heliopolis, and then to the American College in Cairo. Then I moved to Thailand for 2 years. And finally, after finishing school in Thailand, I went to Germany to study medicine. That was a long time ago. And I graduated from Bonn, the University of Bonn, virtually, well, after a few years, I went into science and became a laboratory scientist combined with clinical work. So I worked in medical microbiology and infectious diseases all my life, actually. I started doing research, when was that? My God, 50 years ago. And went through the different stages, became professor of microbiology, and was called to the chair of the Department of Medical Microbiology at the University of Mainz. That was 30 years ago. Gosh, yes, 30 years ago.
We're making you feel very, very old today. That's the whole point of this interview.
Yes, and I retired 8 years ago.
You've had this long, distinguished career. You've studied medicine. You retired in 2012. It's 8 years later, and now you write a very controversial book. Why aren't you just enjoying life? Why did you feel the need to speak out about what you feel is the problem with how we're measuring coronavirus cases, how we're responding to the virus, and many other issues that you take issue with?
Well, I and my wife are not doing this for fun. We in March, when the first lockdown was looming, sort of, we thought, this is weird. The situation, there's something wrong about the whole business, the whole story, because it's out of this world. It cannot be true.
Why not? Why do you say that? Every government in the world seemingly has accepted this idea that lockdowns are the way to deal with this. Why isn't it the right solution?
Exactly. That's what we couldn't understand. And that's why we started making these videos, trying to reach out to the public, to everyone in the social media, since the mainstream media were certainly going the other way, dragging everyone, what is it? Like the Pied Piper, you know, people following the tone of the Pied Piper, but it wasn't the rats anymore. It was the population all around the world. And we couldn't believe it. So we stood up and said, people, now, why do you believe everything you're being told? Why don't you sit down and read and think a bit? Because if you did that, you would very quickly realize that there's something very, very fishy going on. You started, you know, with the definition of what is COVID-19? Originally, COVID-19 was defined as the severe illness caused by a virus named SARS-CoV-2, all right? It was so complicated that no normal person could understand what was going on. And that was the beginning of the end. Because then, you know, this PCR test came out and became the gold standard for diagnosing COVID-19. Now, anyone who studied, you know, infectious diseases knows that a PCR test cannot be used to diagnose anything. A PCR test is a lab test that may be used to support a diagnosis. So if you think someone is ill, has fever, is coughing, and, you know, is short of breath, then it's quite legitimate to do a PCR test to try to find the gene of that virus that you're looking for. And if you find it, or parts of the gene, because a PCR test only looks at parts of the virus genome, very small parts, then it's okay. Then you say, all right, this is would confirm the clinical diagnosis. But a real doctor doesn't go around testing people with a test that has never been put on the market for use to diagnose a disease. It's only there to see whether you have parts of this virus genome, you know, sitting around in your throat or your nose. And then the terrible thing was that whenever this PCR test was positive, that person or patient was labeled COVID-19 case. But COVID-19 is the term used for the disease. And that's where everything really started getting crazy, because this virus, that's the second thing, this virus was termed a new virus and COVID-19 was termed a new disease. But in fact, neither the virus is really new, nor is the disease really new, because the coronaviruses have been with us, with man, since the beginning of mankind. You know, these are viruses that coexist with us. And so every year and every few months, a virus will change a little bit because they mutate all the time. Mm-hmm. They have to mutate, otherwise they can't keep on, you know, going back and forth between you and me and animals or whatever you want. So it's a completely normal thing that these viruses, which are the most successful viruses in the world, together with the flu viruses, by the way, because they manage to keep the host alive. They don't kill the host. They don't want to kill us. They want to come and visit me, and then they want to go and visit the next guy, you know? And in order to be able to do this, they change very little all the time, so that when they come back next year, they can come and visit me again. Otherwise, my immune system, you know, would not allow their entry at all. You see, this is something that people don't really understand. So when we started reading up to see what's going on, we realized that no one knew about this. So we tried to tell the people, you know, a positive PCR does not mean that you are infected. It could mean that, you were infected and now they're just pieces of the genome lying in your throat, and you take a swab and take it out, and then this PCR machine, you know, multiplies that genome. So the number of cycles will tell you how many times this genome has been multiplied. It's like, you know, sort of an alcohol breath test. You drink one mil of vodka, you're not drunk, but if you drink 100, you are drunk. So you get caught in the police control and you do this breath test, and you've only drunk 1 milliliter. So the police say, okay, keep on going. We see that you did drink a bit, but you drank so little that you didn't reach the red mark.
Mm. Mm. Finally, you've put it into language Francis can understand, Dr. Yeah. Bhakti. Thank you for that.
Yeah, so the PCR machine actually tells you, you know, the number of cycles, the cycle threshold that it went through until the test was deemed positive. But the cycle threshold has never been standardized, you know. So, in fact, when the PCR machine says you're positive, it might have just measured 1 mil of the vodka, you know, 0.05, but you're still tested positive. Now, while the police say, okay, keep on driving, your politicians now say you go into quarantine.
But Dr. Bhakti, I want to ask you a question. So you say there's something fishy going on. Could you expand? What do you mean by that?
It means that the way of, first of all, diagnosing this disease, COVID-19, is at variance with everything that anyone learns in infectious diseases. You're using a lab test to make a very serious diagnosis, all right? Now, as I said, this PCR test will light up if you have 0.05 per mil in your blood of alcohol. This is the same thing. And yet you're deemed to be COVID-19 case. That means that you have a serious disease and you enter the records as a COVID-19 case.
So to put it in very simple language for people listening, what you're really saying is the PCR test is likely to massively exaggerate the number of people who are actually suffering symptoms of COVID-19.
Oh, yes, horribly. I mean, so much that it's criminal to say that these are COVID-19 cases. Because everyone in the world believes, oh, my God, you know, now we've had 250,000 COVID-19 cases in Germany. But in fact, you probably have had, I wouldn't be able even to estimate, I can tell you that probably, and we've had 10,000 COVID-19 deaths. But of these 10,000 COVID-19 deaths, 90% were deaths due to other causes, like heart attack or stroke or whatever. It's just that they happen to test positive for this damn virus.
Mm.
With a PCR test that lights up the moment bits and pieces of this virus or another virus that is related to this virus has gotten into your throat, you know?
So, Dr. Bhakti, if this is...
Okay. That's the first part. So what we're learning is that the PCR test was never meant to be the diagnosis for viral load or viral infection. And yet that's exactly how it's been misused. And also, he's distinguishing between a person that tests positive, but it's not specific. It can be for any number of COVID viruses that a person is exposed to over the years. And it only measures particles, and then it has to amplify it. And if you get a large number of amplifications, then clearly that is a person who's not at risk to themselves or anyone else. It doesn't matter. They're considered a case active, and they're not. So this is not just applying bad scientific principles from a test that is faulty to a standard of diagnosis that is completely fraudulent. This is weaponizing a test to get a high number of people to show they're positive so you can continue lockdown draconian laws. In Denmark and around the world, Australia in particular, is probably the worst in Australia. If you don't get a vaccine coming up in Australia, 5 years in prison and a $66,000 fine. We're going to take you to a part two of this, and then we're going to show you what they did, a very short clip in Denmark, where the people rose up. They said, no, we're not going to become a dictatorship, and that's where all this is going. Remember, every time a governor, a mayor, a White House, a CDC, Anthony Fauci, says, we know best, they've never been right. They're always wrong. And they never relinquish the power they have over you. And the public doesn't realize how smart this move is so that they eliminate all dissent. Google, it's on their side. Facebook, Wikipedia, Twitter, all on their side. The New York Times, fully in their pocket. They control the media. So that's why, listen carefully what he has to say. He's telling you the truth. He has no reason, except he is so frustrated by all the lies he's hearing in science. But now other scientists are coming forward also with the same courage to speak out. Let's hear the short 2-minute conclusion to this part of his talk.
Scientific reason is lying.
Do you have a business? Do you want to make the most of your business? Do you want to advertise online? I trust what you're saying. Then why is it we're going into lockdown? Because you can't be the only person to think this. I'm sure there's great swathes in the medical profession that do.
Well, to our great relief, the world's foremost epidemiologist, Professor John Ioannidis of Stanford, actually published a paper that was back 3 weeks ago. And this paper is peer-reviewed. It means that it's been seen by 3 to 4 experts, leading experts in the field. And the WHO put this paper on its bulletin, which means the WHO accepts that this is the correct data. All right? And you go and read that paper, because John Ioannidis said what we said months ago, that this virus is no more deadly than a seasonal flu. And for people under 70, it is even less deadly than the seasonal flu. If you are under 70, your chances of dying with or because of this virus are less than 0.1%. All right? In fact, they are about 0.05%. This means that 5 out of 10,000 infected people may die because of the virus. 5 out of 10,000. This is so little that there's no reason to do anything. Not only the lockdown is nonsense, everything else is nonsense. Everything. And this is published. Everyone who's watching now should stop and think for a moment. Anyone can look at this paper. Anyone can look at the bulletin of WHO and should. And then they should come back and say, listen, since it is now internationally accepted that this virus is not the killer virus that one thought it was, And now, since the pandemic has actually come to an end, the epidemic does not exist in Europe. It does not exist in America. The number of cases and fatalities have almost gone down to zero. Anyone who says that anything is being done for any scientific reason is lying.
Okay, you heard him. They're lying. And I've been saying this all along, that he is not, and no one that I know is in denial of the virus or that it can kill people, but just like the flu, and the flu kills young people, children, babies, senior citizens, by the tens of thousands every year. And now we have another phenomena. The CDC is no longer counting, for the first time, flu, influenza, and pneumonia deaths. And guess where those are all being attributed? To COVID. They're doing it in Canada as well. I mean, this is just, at every way you look at this, we have been manipulated, all for financial gains. In Denmark, they went to the streets just yesterday, or the day before. We're going to play you a very short clip. It's only about 50 seconds, and you can watch it as well. They fought back. They won.
Epidemic law and a ban. Yes! Denmark did it. This is so amazing, guys. Share the good news, please. Share. Denmark has thrown the epidemic law down the drain. Yes! I'm so happy I can't even speak. I'm crying. This is such a relief. And for you who are tuning in who doesn't know anything of what has been happening, Denmark has had an epidemic law that was completely insane. They were trying to impose on its people, and we have been fighting here for over a week with pots and pans demonstration outside where everyone is sitting in the Danish parliament, and finally we've gotten through to them. Today was the day where it was supposed to be decided if this law went through or not. I'm sorry, I'm holding my phone here and I'm shaking because I'm just so happy. This is such a relief. If that law had been going through, Denmark would have been a dictatorship and it would have been so awful. There would have been forced vaccinations, forced medications, all bad things you can ever imagine. And if you're interested in finding out more, go and look at my other lives and you can see. I just wanted to share the good news with you guys, and I wanted to thank you for all your support, and you have been so amazing sharing.
Good. We would not have known that. Hundreds of thousands of Danes went to the street in a peaceful demonstration. And I want to thank J.P. Maurin, M-A-U-R-I-N, who sent me that clip. I believe he's in Germany, a medical student or legal student of some type. Don't know his full background, but he sent some pretty good information. We have to share this information. Now, I'm going to run through several things very quickly just to show you how what's happening actually is now undermining the official dialogue. Anthony Fauci, the House leadership, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the Pence, Mike Pence is a COVID task force, all the people who were telling us what we should do and why, they're all wrong. This is today from ProPublica. Rapid testing is less accurate than the government wants to admit. Quote, rapid antigen testing is a mess. The federal government pushed it out without a plan and then spent weeks denying problems with false positives. And then it says here, quote, by September, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services had purchased more than 150 million tests for nursing homes and schools, spending more than $760 million. But it soon became clear that antigen testing, and named for the viral proteins or antigens that the test detects, posed a new set of problems. Unlike lab tests based upon PCR tests, which detect snippets of the virus genetic material, antigen tests are less sensitive because they only can detect samples with a higher viral load. The tests were prone to more false negatives and false positives. With the benefit of hindsight, experts said the Trump administration should have released antigen tests primarily to communities with outbreaks instead of expecting them to work just as well in large groups of asymptomatic people. And then it says, understanding then they can produce false results, the government could have ensured that clinics had enough for repeat testing to reduce false negatives and access to more precise PCR tests to weed out false positives. Government agencies were aware of the test limitations, could have built up trust by being more transparent, but didn't. And when health care workers in Nevada and Vermont reported false positives, Human Health and Human Services defended the tests and threatened Nevada with unspecified sanctions until state officials agreed to continue using them in nursing homes. It took several more weeks for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to issue an alert on November 3rd that confirmed that Nevada experienced antigen tests were prone to giving false positives. Okay, that's one. What that means in lay language is the government had false tests out there. There was no gold standard. I've told everyone there's no gold standard. The tests are crappy. They shouldn't be used. They should work on a test that is a gold standard and with no false positive or no false negatives. They haven't done that. So think of all the people who were told, oh, you have COVID. You have an active case. You're positive. And they had nothing. They had no case. Now those go into the false buildup of all the cases that are positive. And that's completely a fallacious, it doesn't work at all. So that's one. Also, this is from Tyler Duren, Zero Hedge. Quote, the BBC recently reported some shocking statistics regarding UK health, but which will perhaps come as no surprise to those critics who warned that far-reaching national lockdowns would cause other unseen adverse effects. Compared to normal years, there has been more deaths at home from a number of major causes, including cancers and respiratory diseases, during the last 6 weeks. How many extra? The analysis from Britain's Office of National Statistics found more than 26,000 extra deaths occurred in private homes this year, while simultaneously hospital deaths have been lower than usual. Quote, more men than normal are dying at home from heart disease in England and Wales, and more women are dying from dementia and Alzheimer's. Remember what I said at the beginning of this program? When people were afraid to go to the hospital, they stayed at home and didn't get the therapy that could have helped them and saved their lives, they died, all considered COVID. So now we're seeing that these draconian laws for lockdown are dangerous. This is from Queen Mary University in London. Quote, obese people found to be at an increased risk of COVID-19. A new study led by researchers at Queen Mary University in London showed that when you're overweight, you have a much greater chance of cardiovascular risk and the rise of COVID-19 infections. We've known this from the beginning. So why has there not been a single thing anywhere in the world, not a single thing, to help people who are overweight and obese become normalized and allow those people to be put on to heart healthy and proper programs in order to save their life? So the most vulnerable are not the children in school and not the babies and not the daycares and not the teenagers, not the college students, not everybody else who doesn't have comorbidity, but the obese, and nothing being done to help them. Also, just as an aside, I want to say you are real heroes. The Dorothy Day League, an act of love, an act of justice, the anti-nuclear plowshares activists, they're going to prison for a naval base protest. And now there's a bunch of them. I believe that there's seven peace group members were sentenced last week to 10 to 14 months in prison, plus probation and restitution payments, for trespassing on a Georgia naval base to protest U.S. nuclear weapons policy. They are right. They are true heroes. not a word in the media about them. But who should be condemned? Joe Biden was responsible for this, and also this happened under Barack Obama. He increased the budget by $1 trillion for nukes. He was pro-nukes, and he sponsored nuclear research, and he was the one that these people were originally protesting. It's just taken this long for them to be tried. But they're all going to jail for saying something that any reasonable and responsible moral person would say. We should be de-escalating all nuclear weapons, not increasing them. So the good people are in jail, and Barack Obama's in Martha's Vineyard, and the next president who supported all this, that laughing, demented fool, that's who you wanted, that's who you got. Nothing's going to change. This is from American Institute for Economic Research, an article published in the New England Journal of Medicine. A study that goes to the heart of issue of lockdowns. The question has always been whether or to and to what extent a lockdown, however extreme, is capable of suppressing the virus. If so, you can make an argument that at least lockdowns, despite their astronomical social and economic and human costs, achieve something. If not, nations of the world have embarked on a catastrophic experiment that has destroyed billions of lives and all expectation of human rights and liberties destroyed with no payoff at all. Quote, the earliest version of a major article has, quote, long highlighted studies that show no gain in virus management from lockdowns. Even as early as April, a major data scientist said that this virus becomes endemic in 70 days after the first round of infection, regardless of policies. The largest global study of lockdowns compared with deaths, as published in The Lancet, found no association between coercive stringencies and deaths per million. Hence, the lockdowns do not reduce any of this. So, these are some things that fall right into what we've been saying and actually support this. And so, also one of the, by the way, all the COVID vaccine test subjects were not given informed consent, and nobody informed them of the dangers of this. That's important. So that's very important. And before we go to this last couple of clips, I'll be doing one more anti-aging study. It's a repeat to make sure we get the same results of our third study, which we just finished 4 weeks ago. And if we are able to duplicate it, then we've set two historical markers this year. First, for the first time in world history, we've actually shown with human clinical trials, non-medical, no stem cells, nothing like that, just with very strict diet, exercise protocols, meditation, self-actualizations, juicing, etc., that we could reverse active biological markers, which we proved these markers were done before and after. I decided, let's see if we can do it in a shorter period of time instead of 2 months. Can we do it in 2 weeks? We did it in 2 weeks. Improved itself. Now I got to duplicate it. So that's going to come the last 2 weeks of April. If you'd like to join us, you can give Luann Panessi a call. I don't have time to go further into it, but at the same time, we're also going to do it. At the same time, we're doing a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI. People who will be there and enjoying everything they want, but they don't have to follow the strict protocols. The people in the study have to follow the strict protocols. You can call Luann at 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. And I had a person who I've known for a long time call and say, you don't really believe all this anti-aging stuff. I mean, really, do you? Do you? And I said, well, I'll tell you what. You and I are the same age. We were born a month apart. This was yesterday, by the way. I said, I'm going to go take a picture of myself. Just got out of the shower. Hair's a mess. I'm not going to blow it out. I'm not going to, no makeup, just right in the sun. Nothing's hidden. I'm going to post a picture of myself today. You send me a picture of yourself in a pair of gym shorts, and let's see. We're both the same identical age. Look how much different we look. So I did that. So my picture is up there. I'm waiting for his. Hopefully he'll send it, and when he does, I'll post it beside mine. So yeah, we were right. Yeah, you can reverse the aging process. Yes, you can slow it down so you're half the age biologically that you are chronologically. So 60, you can become the new 40. 50, you can become the new 25. 70, you can become the new 45. Yes, at the biological level. And we're proving it scientifically. But you can go to prn.fm and you can see that photograph for yourself. Nothing done. That's who I am. And that sends a powerful message to people. You too can do that. Now we're going to play this clip of just a stranger helping another stranger.
Time he was 30 years old. He had a degree in the music business and owned his own company. It started out as a regular trip to his local Kroger, and the supermarket was located in an upper-class area of Memphis, Tennessee. Matt went into the store, got everything on his list, cashed out, and headed out the door. For him, it was just like every other trip to the supermarket. He had no idea that this day was about to take a strange turn. He looked up and saw a teenage boy walking toward him who looked embarrassed and uncomfortable. He couldn't figure out why. The teen walking towards Matt was Chauncey Jones Black. He had taken a bus from his neighborhood to get to what he called the Rich People's Kroger. The 16-year-old was going there in hopes of getting food in exchange for work. He'd been there most of the day, and he only had 1 hour left before he had to catch the last bus home. He knew that his mother would be waiting, so he had to be sure to catch that bus. He hoped Matt would be able to help him, so he walked over to him. Chauncey went over and asked if he could carry his load of groceries to his truck in exchange for a pack of glazed donuts. The teen was hungry, and he wanted to have something to bring home to his mother. Well, Matt felt sorry for Chauncey, so he agreed. While the teen was loading Matt's groceries in the car, he asked him a bit about Chauncey's life. Chauncey told him that his mother struggled to support the family. They didn't have a phone, barely any money for food. The teen told Matt that all he had in the world were the clothes on his back and his bus pass. Matt was moved by Chauncey's story, and the two went into the grocery store to get Chauncey the payment for his work. When the two went in, they got the donuts that Matt promised. He didn't want to send the teen home, though, with just a box of donuts. So they started shopping. He filled the cart with essentials like cereal, pasta, fruit, peanut butter, milk, and soap. Chauncey couldn't believe how kind Matt was being. While shopping, the two continued talking. Chauncey told Matt about his life, school, and his mother. He told Matt that he got straight A's in school and hoped to get a job soon so that he could help his mother pay the rent. Matt was amazed by this teen. Despite the boy's difficult home life, he still managed to excel in school, and he took the time to work to bring home food for his family. So Matt wanted to do more. Chauncey told Matt several times that his family was poor. He said that he wanted to do well in school so that he could own his own business one day so that he could afford to help people in his town. Matt was becoming more and more impressed with this teen by the second. When they cashed out, Matt watched as Chauncey headed to the bus stop. He didn't want him riding the bus with all the grocery bags, though, so he decided to offer the boy a ride home. When they got to Chauncey's home, Matt realized he wasn't exaggerating about his home life. There was no furniture in the house. Matt and his mother lived in a home in South Memphis, and they didn't even have beds. They slept on pads made from sleeping bags. They had nothing in the house, only two lamps and a refrigerator, and the refrigerator was completely bare. When Matt met the teen's mother, Barbara, he understood why the family was struggling. She was very frail. She suffered from a condition that made it painful for her to even move. Matt decided he needed to do more for this family in need. Matt helped Chauncey fill the refrigerator and the cupboards, and he left. The thought of this struggling family haunted Matt, though, so he did some research on the family. He learned that they'd been living in poverty for years, trying to survive on Barbara's disability checks. Although Matt lived a comfortable life, he didn't have the money to support a family, so he decided to find help elsewhere. Matt went home and created a GoFundMe page for the family. He asked for donations and included Chauncey's clothing size. He told the teen's story and how he was working hard to support his mother. Matt was hoping to get some clothes for the teen and maybe buy him a lawnmower so he could cut grass for money to help his family. Matt never expected it to become so much more than that. Matt's post went viral, and it was shared over 14,000 times. It received over 3,500 comments. People started making cash donations. They sent food, clothing, and even offered free dental care. Matt was shocked when he saw the story had brought in over $340,000. A lawyer helped the family manage the money, and they moved into a new home in a better area. They were able to get furniture, and Chauncey would have a fully paid college education. There was also enough money for the family to stay afloat. Chauncey and Barbara say that they owe Matt everything. This teen offered to carry a man's groceries for food. He had no idea who he was approaching. He was approaching somebody who was about to change his life. What have you done recently?
We should ask ourselves, what have we done? I want to thank Jane Fonda for her anti-war, feminism, and climate change policies. She's an activist. She cares. Oliver Stone for his anti-war, climate change, international relations, gay rights challenges that he's put out there. He's helped. Sean Penn on the international relations with Cuba and Venezuela, climate change against the Iraq war and gay rights. He's made a difference. Martin Sheen, anti-war, anti-nuclear, environmental, workers' rights. He's been arrested over 60 times in protest. Daryl Hannah, various pipelines that she stood there willing to be arrested and was, on against fracking and for the environment. Neil Young, various pipelines, mining, against big agriculture. Joan Baez, still active, human and civil rights, anti-war. Susan Sarandon, anti-racism. She was arrested at ICE protests. UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. Danny Glover, human and civil rights environmentalist, progressive politics. Willie Nelson, for the pipelines he's been against, the fracking he's against, and against big agriculture. And also George Clooney, human rights, especially in Africa. He's been arrested at protests in the Sudan embassy. Cher, Veterans Affairs, anti-war, Flint water crisis, AIDS relief, anti-Trump, environmental policies. Mark Ruffalo, environmental protests, XL pipeline, water rights. I spent an hour talking with Mark up on Broadway recently about his activism. Cate Blanchett, ecological conservation, women's rights, refugee protection. Sting, many environmental issues, funded the Rainforest Foundation. Natalie Portman, anti-child abuse, trafficking, and climate change, animal rights, longtime vegan. Barbara Streisand, climate change, against nuclear power and anti-war. Alec Baldwin, animal rights, indigenous rights, environmental rights, anti-nuclear. I never will forget, it was recently running in the morning outside Center Park down Broadway and hear, "Hey, Gary," I look over and there's Alec riding on a bike and just gave a thumbs up. We've been at demonstrations or at meetings together. Cynthia Nixon, public education, immigration, gay rights. Pearl Jam on the environment, Tibet, big agriculture. Woody Harrelson on the environment, legalization of marijuana, and Michael J. Fox on stem cell research, and many more. I just want to let you know there's a lot of good people out there doing good things, using their celebrity status in a positive way. But let us not forget the non-celebrities. Who comes to the rescue of those who are not able to survive? They're in their homes. Water's flooding. It's the average working person in America. They bring their little boats out. They'll wade with, you know, up to their chest in toxic water, carrying people to safety. When are they ever thanked? And yet every Hurricane Katrina, every hurricane, I've seen them here in Florida. During the daytime, these people are masons and roofers, and they are landscapers, just regular people. But they're good people. They're always there when there's a crisis. That tells me who they are. You know who I don't see there in a crisis? Ever? I don't see the politicians in Washington. I don't see Nancy Pelosi, even when she was younger. I don't see any of those politicians. I don't see the people who are the celebrities on CNN or any of the other stations. I don't see any of these people. I don't see the doctors and lawyers and dentists. There might be a few, but by and large, no. They're up in their skyscrapers. They got power coming from the roof on their generators. Everyone else, the poor people, they got 5 feet of water. 21 trillion gallons of water fell in Houston. I didn't see any of the scientists, the professors. I didn't see the people who are the high-end megastars of Silicon Valley. I didn't see Elon Musk. I didn't see any of these people out there risking their life to get an infection in toxic water, but I did see the average citizen, the one that is denigrated and called names and spat upon. I see them every time there's a crisis. That tells me who is a real human being and who's just pretending. Thank you for listening and have a nice day.